From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made sometime in the Stone Age. See, a group of Stone Agers were gathered around a fire, roasting some meat that they had captured that day, and Biff, a young Stone Ager, turned to Grok, who was doing the cooking, and Biff said he was worried that red meat might be bad for his heart. He had read that in some stone journal, and he didn't really have a balanced diet. Grok thought about it for a moment, and then he replied, "Biff, you can have meat tonight. Everything in moderation." And just like that, the only food advice we'll ever need was coined. Look, I don't know who was the actual first person to use that phrase, everything in moderation, but most professionals who work in diet and health cringe when they hear it. And you'll read in a lot of places, it's bad advice. In recent years, there's been a surge in pushback against this idea. And that gave us some ideas. Many of us spent last Thursday eating like we were trying to store food for an endless barren winter. And many of us are trying to avoid excess eating or poor choices this holiday season. So we're asking our panelists to tell us, what dietary ideas or cliches drive them up the wall? And how can we make better choices more consistently? What are the food mistakes we most commonly make? Hello to our guests in studio. Dr. Tom Campbell is here, medical director of Highland Hospital's Weight Management and Lifestyle Center. And we've seen Dr. Campbell before. It's nice to have you back here.
Hello. Thank you.
Also with us is Dr. Barbara Losey, and a registered dietitian and the head of the Wegman School of Health and Nutrition at RIT. Barbara, welcome
Hello.
To you. Also with us is Barrett Young, a registered dietitian and nutritionist and owner, the personality behind the Cupcake Dietitian. Barrett, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
And Emily Kyle is a registered dietitian and owner of Emily Kyle Nutrition. Emily, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
Everything in moderation, right?
That's right. That's what they say.
Is that not right?
Depends on who you ask.
Well, I'm asking you. What do you feel about moderation here? Are we addicted to this idea that we can get away with eating this or that on any given day because we justify it with everything in moderation?
I think the sentence should be everything in moderation, including moderation.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Ooh, I like that.
Dr. Campbell, does it drive you up the wall?
It does a little bit. You know, they did a study on what does moderation mean to people? What is the actual, what is that word? How do people define that word? And they did a variety of very interesting research where they brought plates of very junky food and set them in front of people, things that everybody knows are unhealthy, you know, pizza, gummy worms, etc. And people found that moderation was sort of set at a level slightly more than what they would prefer to consume. So the conclusion was moderation is not useful.
Okay. When we talk about moderation, I wouldn't even think it would be medically useful because it would mean something different for every person anyway, right?
Well, exactly. So if you prefer, you know, 2 gummy worms, then a moderate amount would be 3 gummy worms. If you prefer 10 gummy worms, if that's your candy of choice, a moderate amount would be 12 gummy worms in this particular study. So, you know, but I see that all the time. I think the most common rationalization that we have when I work with patients is that is a sense of this little bit won't hurt, right? And that's very similar to this moderation idea, is that if you say this little bit won't hurt, well, you know, chances are most of the people that I'm working with is that this little bit is pretty, you add up enough little bits and it does begin to hurt. It's sort of death by 1,000 cuts.
And let me, before I jump to the other panelists here, on the subject of everything in moderation, look, if you eat 500 bell peppers, you're going to be in trouble. But there are certain foods that eating a lot of is generally a very good idea. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And, you know, in terms of weight in particular, the topic you've brought up is that there's this idea of called calorie density, which is, you know, in a certain volume or weight of food, there's a certain number of calories. And generally that it's very hard to overeat foods that are lower in calorie density. I mean, you'd have to eat wheelbarrow fulls of non-starchy vegetables to get enough calories for the day. So it's, you know, but unfortunately, most people are eating stuff that's very high in calorie density. And particularly this time of year, you know, the eating season, I call it, from Thanksgiving to Christmas is when we really kind of throw caution to the wind and bring out all the high calorie density foods. And it's everything in moderation, which is a sign to go ahead and enjoy yourself.
Exactly. It's a big old cop-out. Barbara, how do you feel about everything in moderation? When you hear it said at your table, what do you hear?
I think it's kind of a useless phrase, actually. Because you talk about moderation, you could talk about amount as well as type, or, you know, the actual foods that you're eating. And the approach that I would use more is a term called eating competence. And that's where you give yourself permission to eat the foods you want in the amounts you want, but you give yourself the discipline to be able to make sure that you're eating foods that are in an amount that is going to satisfy you, and that foods that are going to be healthful for you. Eating competence has four main components to it that I think fit with the moderation aspect. First of all, eating competence has to do with internal regulation, that you listen to your body, that you eat until you're satisfied and when you're hungry, but you also learn to accept many different types of foods and experiment with food, and you also have a good attitude towards food. You enjoy it, and you're comfortable with your enjoyment of eating. And then what dietitians usually talk a lot about is the eating context. You plan meals, you have regular meals, you pay attention to things that are good for yourself. And that sounds kind of like, oh my gosh, here we are talking about no specific type of food or amount of food. And yet the research that we've done, we've published this in Journal of Nutrition, Appetite, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics Journal, has shown that people who follow an eating competent approach have better sleep hygiene, which sleep is very highly related to health and to what we eat. They are more physically active. They have a better diet quality, better healthy eating index, and you know, just lots of those positive outcomes, because that's what we're really looking for when we're talking about eating, is having health. I mean, that's what we're really concerned about, is good health.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean, though, that you would recommend fully eliminating any particular foods?
I don't recommend fully eliminating any particular foods, because you need to look at, you need to enjoy your eating, and you need to be comfortable with your enjoyment of eating. But the bottom line is, you need to give yourself discipline that you're going to consider what's going to be healthful for you, and you're going to have regular meals. And I think the other dietitians and Dr. Campbell would agree, regular meals, regular eating patterns are really related to good health.
Well, I'm going to come in a moment. I'm going to come back to Dr. Campbell and see if he agrees on what not eliminating any food. We'll see. Barrett, how do you feel about this notion of moderation that we hear all the time?
Yeah, I think the issue with it is moderation looks differently to everybody, right? So moderation to one person could be one burger a week. To the next person, it could be one burger a month. Next person, one burger a year. So that term moderation.
Or a burger a day.
Right, exactly.
A trip to McDonald's every afternoon, but not twice a day.
Not twice a day, because only in moderation, right?
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
So, we throw that term out, and it helps people feel a little bit better about trying to find this healthy mindset around eating. But it's a different definition for everyone. So I think it's individually based. And, you know, and what Barbara was saying, it's almost like instead of saying everything in moderation, when you do choose to indulge in something, because that's life and everyone's going to do that and that's fine, just make sure you're mindful of it and how much you're eating. And is it because you really want it? Or is it because it's the holidays and you have to have three pieces of pie because it's Thanksgiving, you know? So it's different for everyone. And I think getting rid of the term moderation and more or less looking at maybe why you're eating and in the amount you're eating it and what else is going on in your environment at the time.
Okay. Well, Dr. Campbell, anything that you would eliminate if I came to you and said, all right, doc, what do you want me to do? Anything I should cut out completely?
So, you know, from a nutrition health point of view, I think you can have a robust argument about how much of your diet. I think it's clear that a predominantly plant-based, unrefined plant-based diet is best for health, and personally. And I think the research bears that out in observational research, mechanistic research, intervention research for a variety of health outcomes. But, you know, predominantly plant-based diet. I think from a behavioral point of view, this is where I start getting a little stricter. I think because we live in a very unhealthy food environment, our social connections generally are pulling us, for most people I work with, are pulling us to unhealthy foods. We can't buy a 2x4 without passing a gauntlet. I mean, they were giving away free donuts this past weekend at the, you know, at my local hardware store. So, you know, you it's very hard to go into that kind of environment and negotiate with yourself, negotiate with your own brain to sort of, because your brain wants those calorie dense foods. It's very hard to go into that unhealthy food environment and negotiate with yourself and say, oh, you know, I'll have a bite of this now and I'll go easy later. Generally, that's almost harder. That's almost harder, I think. So in my, you know, in some of the research, for example, on heart disease reversal, they do say, you know, eliminate meat. eliminate meat, and some of the research eliminate most dairy, most or all dairy, and people do very well. People do very, very well on that. And so I think that you can have a robust health eliminating certain animal products. You know, my passion is plant-based for sure, but I think that you could have a robust argument, you know, could 10% of your diet be, you know, plant-based, animal-based foods, for example, and maybe have exceptional health. I mean, I think the other issue, in addition to just animal versus plants, is processed foods. I mean, that I think is almost a bigger issue in American culture. The majority of what we eat is highly processed foods. And you know, look, I think you can't have one donut hole a day. I mean, it's easier to say, no, that's not my food. I'm not going to eat that anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. And in a moment, I want to ask all of our panelists how we kind of create environments around us, or if we can. That are, because Dr. Campbell is so right. There's a box of donut holes 10 feet from us. And I think that was Juan or Randy, and I do it too. I mean, I'm not throwing them under the bus. I fully participate. I bring stuff into work, or it's everywhere, the hardware store. But just to the point you're making there, I remember I used to, you know, like any college student, grab fast food burgers, hit the drive-thru. And I remember, the summer after I graduated, I just said, I don't want that anymore. I don't want to crave it anymore, because I actually crave it. So I convinced myself, well, I had one this week, or I went twice, and I don't want to crave it anymore. So I thought, it's going to be hard, but if I stop eating it entirely, I will stop craving it eventually. And now I don't crave fast food burgers at all. On the rare occasions they enter my sphere, I actually kind of feel mildly ill from them. And I wonder, so is that part of the deal? Because when we get to the holiday season and go, well, I'm going to have three pieces of pie, it's mm-hmm. one night. But if you can change the way you eat in 12 months, can you get to the end of the year and say, I don't crave those things anymore. I actually don't even want them. I don't even care if they're around.
Yeah, I think that idea, that body of evidence regarding the addictive properties of food plays a role into the whole conversation, because, you know, I can't advise someone to quit smoking and say, oh, if you have a great week, go ahead and enjoy a cigarette on Saturday. You know, and so there's a body of literature suggesting that sugar and fat, particularly heavily processed foods, you know, sugar and fat do have some addictive properties. And you know, and that's kind of where the behavioral, you know, you can discuss the nutritional implications of small amounts of meat or small amounts of anything, quite frankly, and it's probably okay from a nutrition health point of view. But from a behavioral point of view, I think it's easier to go 100%, and that addresses more the addiction aspect of things.
All right. So how are we going to create better spaces? Are you guys pretty good at this? Do you tell your coworkers don't bring stuff in? Like, that's not good for anybody. Or do they say, oh boy, here comes Emily again, she's gonna give us a hard time, I brought cookies to the office?
People do say that, and it's kind of annoying, but agreed. Why can't we change the culture? Why can't we bring a fruit basket or an edible arrangement? But it's up to us to change the culture. One person has to make the change, and other people will eventually follow.
You think they will change, though?
I think so. I think that the amount of people that are concerned with their health, especially as we go into January, we're going to start seeing people who, and especially that community aspect, when one person wants to get healthy, you kind of see other people starting to want to get healthy. And I think it is a spiral effect, that it needs to be started with one person, though.
Well, it could be started with that guy. Look at Rob Braden. Show us again. Rob's got a pile of fruit behind the glass today.
Exactly.
We've got donuts in the newsroom, and Braden has got a pile of fruit. Rob, though, I want to ask you, did you have a donut, though? Yes, he did. Okay, so and so seriously, I think Emily's making a good point, though. I mean, it probably doesn't work if you're the only person in the office doing it, and everybody goes, oh, well, here comes Buzzkill Emily Kyle. But if you get other people to kind of get on that train with you, you know, it becomes sort of more of a groupthink mentality.
Right, and when we think about, okay, I'm going to bring donuts because it's quick and easy to stop at Dunkin' Donuts and grab it, well, it's just as easy these days to stop into Wegmans and grab a cut. Pre-cut tray of fruit or vegetables. So when we think about convenience, we also need to take that in consideration and think about that there are healthy options that are just as easy. We just need to take that extra step.
Well, you bring up an important point here, which brings me to another question for the panel then, which is, are there other misconceptions about food that drive you up the wall? And is one of them this idea that, well, it's more expensive to eat healthy, so I'm just not going to do it? You bring up a vegetable or a fruit tray. which, you know, I mean, in certain places can be $16-$20. And some people say, well, I don't want to spend that. I'll get a box of cookies or something like that that's less. You know, so I'll go around the table and I'll start with Emily. Do you talk to patients, or if you talk to clients who are telling you, I can't afford to, quote, eat healthy. Does that sort of...
Yeah, and I think it's different with each client, but each person values things differently. And it's about, when I'm working with clients, bringing their value back to healthful food and also giving them, you know, other alternatives and ways to shop more budget friendly, but also talking about, what are you really paying for? What are you really getting? And in the long run, what are you going to pay for?
Okay.
Yeah. I love this, that comment from patients and my perspective, because I was a poor college student for a very long time and I ate healthy and I didn't have a lot of money. So I think a lot of that is just educating and teaching them, you know, how to eat healthy on a budget, and it can be done, and you can still hit your flavor profiles. They just don't know. People don't know. So it's kind of an excuse for them. They don't have to try to eat healthy because they just can't afford it. Well, if you show them that you can buy canned beans, or you can do this with chicken that's healthy that lasts a long time, you know, they're very unaware. So once you teach them and show them, then they feel competent and empowered to do it on their own.
Okay. Yeah. Barbara?
Well, I think a lot of times it's not just the cost, but the time. And a lot of people are concerned about having enough time. And lots of times it isn't just the time, but this concept called executive cognitive function, that just being able to plan for it, to have the brain time to think through purchasing food, or how you're going to prepare it, or when you're going to prepare it, when you're going to have it ready, bringing it back again to the eating competence aspect. You plan your food. You plan when you're going to eat. You plan to have regular meals, or you consider what you're going to purchase to eat. And that makes a huge difference to train people. I hate to use the word train like people are animals or something like that.
I think there's something to that, though.
But to help people gain the value in planning, and to see how it can really help their health, mm-hmm. even as much as thinking through, you know, exactly if I'm eating too much or too little or whatever, and that's where, you know, cooking shows are very popular, and pre-cooked meals and these pre-portioned meals are very popular. A lot of times it's because people need that help to do their executive planning.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tom?
I mean, realize that most of the world's traditional populations have been relatively trim, with very low rates of diabetes, heart disease, and several forms of our more affluent cancers. And, you know, they're not, these are poor populations, and they suffer from diseases of poverty, mm-hmm. of course, but these are poor populations. If you walk into a grocery store, some of the cheapest calories, the cheapest food you can buy are things like potatoes, sweet potatoes, canned beans, grains, whole grains, you know, and that's the base of many of these types of diets. So if you realize that you can have some of these things, that is a very cheap diet, actually. It can be a very inexpensive diet, and you can save money. Where people get confused is when they are eating a diet high in processed foods, and then they still want the breakfast waffles. So they wander over to Nature's Marketplace, and they see the purple breakfast waffles with 16 different types of fancy seeds, and it's like, you know, $8 per waffle. And they think, oh, I can't do this. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's just silly, because that's actually not the type of health that I personally, you know, the type of product that I'd recommend people buy.
Yeah, I mean, and so the idea that if you walk into a grocery store's produce section, it would always be more expensive. I mean, I think it's 89 or 99 cents for a whole bag of baby carrots right now. I mean, if you want to buy a bunch of bell pepper, that's a lot more expensive by the pound. But I think with a little work, to the point mm-hmm. the panel's making, this misconception needs to be tossed aside, that eating, quote, eating healthy is always more expensive. Then there are these ideas that maybe there's just one superfood of the moment. And help me out here. What's the superfood of the moment right now? I mean, kale had its moment. Quinoa has had its moment.
Chia seeds?
Yeah. Having a moment? Okay.
I think coconut oil's moment is passing.
That's passed, yeah.
And that's not to say, like, kale is not a great thing, or quinoa, though there's questions about sourcing and what it impacts on local labor. I mean, there's all kinds of interconnected questions here. But I want to know from the panel, do we overly fixate on one superfood of the moment at times?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Always. We tend to follow what media and social media says is popular at the time, when really the true superfoods are the foods that come from Mother Nature, that have always been around and that have not been altered or doctored in any way. But that's not sexy. Like, people aren't into that. They want whatever's new and whatever Kim Kardashian's holding online. People want that popularity factor. And simple whole foods just
wants you to hold on to, buy their products. You have to eat all the kale you can in order to be healthy. And it's just silly. Like, I used to tell people all the time, kale's great, but so's spinach and so's broccoli. Like, they're all kind of in the same category, guys. So, yeah, it's all marketing. That's what people need to know. There's no miracle food. There's no food that's just going to change your life one drink at a time. You know, I think kombucha maybe is there right now, right? But it's silly.
And Barbara, you're disabusing us of this desire for, is it chia seeds? Chia seeds.
That's it?
Okay. Well, why not? What if I'm only going to eat chia seeds for a week?
Well, first of all, you'd get very, very tired of eating chia seeds. Just have to ask my husband.
Right. But why do you think we do this? Why do we fixate, sort of, we rotate the focus on it? Is that more of a media creation? I mean, frankly, is it our fault?
It's a media creation as well as we like to have lots different things and, you know, change up things in our diet. We get bored very, very easily. Mm-hmm. And so it's great to try new things. Mm-hmm. It's great to try different foods. But the idea that you're going to eat something and that is what's going to make you healthy, that's the real kind of problem.
Yeah.
Because if you're eating tons of broccoli, but you're also not exercising, you're not sleeping well, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a very healthy person.
Well, and getting bored with food is quite a luxury of the privileged of society, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yep, exactly.
No question. Tom, how do you feel about superfood?
Well, I think that underlying some of that conversation is that lifestyle change is hard. You know, we have to admit that real, genuine, sustained, long-term lifestyle change is hard to do. I mean, you need to challenge and change your habits that you developed with your family, that you currently have with your friends. You need to change your home food environment. You need to change the food that's in your kitchen. All of that is hard. You need to change the way you shop, the way you have to start cooking more. You know, all of that is hard, hard work. And so people want the easy way. And, you probably have as much to say as certainly anyone in this room, that people, I think, in general want to hear good things about their bad habits. You know, they want to, as one prominent doctor said, and if you can say good things about their bad habits in a headline, you get some eyeballs, you get some clicks, you get, you know, and
oh
so
my gosh.
And so this whole environment.
You mean just, if I had a headline, actually, that chocolate cake you had could be good for you.
Yeah.
A million people click on it in right. 5 seconds.
Right. They'd be super happy with you, Evan.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Be just thrilled. So we have this paradigm that reinforces the easy way from a whole different bastion of sources. And we just keep overlooking, because it's hard. It's a hard work of lifestyle change. It's hard work.
Yeah. All right. Let me grab a phone call. This is, speaking of making changes, Kate in Fairport on the phone. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi, Evan. I just wanted to comment because I think this topic is so critical and phenomenal. But I actually traveled to Cleveland Clinic. They put in a new functional medicine institute right in the middle of the hospital. And I know U of R is doing some of those things. But the expert panel is absolutely right on about whole foods. And it's really about changing the attitude. But I know a lot of people that won't change, and will make that argument about cost of healthy food and but I've also seen the changes of the people that are committed to make the changes on chronic conditions, on outcomes, everything from mental health to health crises and whatnot. But the approach that the Functional Medicine Institute takes is the full person solution and making those lifestyle changes that both complement each other. And we have a gem of an expert in Rochester that I hope you interview one day, but Susan Pierce Thompson, who is a retired adjunct professor at University of Rochester in cognitive sciences, and her science and work on how to make those changes that you need to for the betterment and the outcomes that you can make. I just think that health coaches and dietitians are great, but you need to have that long-term commitment, and the people that actually can make the beneficial changes are the ones that stay committed and stay the course. And so whatever you can do to get there, it's critically important. And hospitals like Cleveland Clinic are really leading the way in how to take that approach long-term in working with people individually, but bravo to having this topic, and I just can't express enough how important it is to eating healthy foods and having healthy outcomes. But it is a hard road to change someone's mind.
Well, Kate, thank you very much. Sounds like she's calling from a treadmill. thump, thump. I'm going, this is the healthiest phone call we've ever gotten. On that subject of long-term change, let me ask all of you. I think Kate's making an important point here. Maybe it's just I'm missing it, but I'm seeing less of the fad diets out there, or maybe I'm just in a bubble here. But I feel like we're getting a little bit better at understanding that making a change for a week or a month or even 6 months or a year doesn't really benefit us long term unless it becomes a permanent change. Mm-hmm. Am I in a bubble? Are people getting a little bit better at that, Emily?
Yeah. Yep, you're spot on. We know scientific research backs up that 95% of all diets don't work, and the general public is now starting to accept that. People want quick fixes, and when it comes to health, there really, truly is no quick fix. Yeah, you might lose 5 pounds on a water fast, but it's sustainable long-term changes. People are starting to understand it takes a lifetime. It's a lifetime. And I always tell my clients, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint.
Yeah. I mean, unless you're trying to, you got some weird deadline coming up or a high school reunion that nobody cares about. Right. You know, just don't worry about that. Barrett, how do you feel about sort of fad diets and the long-term aspect?
Yeah. I think that's, we have to keep convincing the public that this is not a month thing. Like, you know, if you want to try the keto diet, good for you, try it for a month, you're going to lose weight, but you're not going to be able to do it forever. It's just, you have to first convince people that, you know, when they do kind of give in to these diets or whatever it may be, you know, is this something you can do for the rest of your life? And just to constantly remind people to be consistent, to be patient, to forgive themselves, and just to keep every single day moving forward and setting some other kind of small goal that will eventually become a habit, and then you just forget you're doing it and it's just part of your life. So it takes a while, and people need to constantly remind themselves of that, because if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, right? Okay. If something's promising a 20-pound weight loss in a month, then that's probably not going to last.
Boy, you would hope we know that by now. Right, Tom? What do you think?
Yeah, so I think there's interesting, you know, I can't quite figure out where we are as a culture. On one hand, anecdotally speaking to people and working with, you know, the hundreds of people that I've worked with, there seems to be an increasingly fervent interest in food as medicine, food as health, and the foodie culture, and whether that's plant-based or the locavore or organic, you know, movement, or, you know, however, whatever iteration of that there is, there seems to be a growing interest. But on the other hand, you look at national statistics, and it's just every year it keeps getting worse and worse. And so the last statistics I saw were that, you know, the most Americans are struggling with weight, more Americans are struggling with weight than ever before. So I think what underlies some of that is that our food environment just keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And yet people, there's increasing minority of people who are learning that struggling against that food environment is the key to really important health things. And so we have this push-pull. And, you know, we'll see how it goes in the future. I'm not quite sure. But yes, as a culture, it seems things are getting worse, and there's less interest in sort of the quick fix. As a culture, it seems like things are getting worse and there's more interest in the quick fix. But then there's this foodie culture that seems to be growing, where the people are very consciously making decisions. And that seems to be leading towards this more sustainable, realistic food choices.
Well, and you know, Barbara, I'm looking at an email from Melissa, who says, talk about a long-term change. I'm tired of health washing. Organic cookies are still cookies. And I'm thinking about, you know, the changes that we convince ourselves that we've made. Well, I used to eat those cookies, but now I get organic cookies that come in a green box that make me feel like, well, that's good for me, you know? And
is good, right?
Do we trick ourselves into thinking we've made real changes with some of these fads?
Oh, definitely. I'd like to go back to your caller for a minute, though, because I thought she raised a good point, and that has to do with the whole idea of preventive medicine and prevention. Mm-hmm. And I think, wonderfully so, society is coming around, and that's why I think hospitals are doing things like having a functional food center into realizing that prevention is where it's at, where the healthcare cost dollar is going to be saved, and where it actually is going to be a lot better for people to learn how to prevent health problems rather than us to treat health problems. I know at RIT, we have a nutrition minor. So even if you're majoring in computer science or photography, you can get a minor in nutrition and learn some things that are really going to help you throughout your life and to be able to help you focus on prevention, which is, I think, where nutrition and healthcare really, you know, could have its impact. Unfortunately, reimbursement, we all know about that. Reimbursement will pay you to see a health nutritionist if you have diabetes, but not before you have diabetes. And that is something that really does need to change too. Mm-hmm. So people are really looking towards what can I do to help prevent health problems down the road? And of course, nutrition is one of the areas that you can.
All right. I have a lineup of listener phone calls, emails to get to. So Tim in Pittsford, we'll get you right after this break. And we've got your emails as well to come. We're talking about our food choices and especially this time of year, but really 12 months out of the year, our food choices, how we can make changes, what are some of the cliches that we ought to get away from, whether it's everything in moderation or otherwise, and how can we do better? And you're hearing Dr. Barbara Losey, who is a registered dietitian and the head of the Wegmans School of Health and Nutrition at RIT. Emily Kyle is a registered dietitian and the owner of Emily Kyle Nutrition. Barrett Young, a registered dietitian and owner of the Cupcake Dietitian, and Dr. Tom Campbell is medical director of Highland Hospital's Weight Management and Lifestyle Center. Your phone calls and emails next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, a documentary called Back to Natural explores the relationship between politics, hair, and racial identity in Black communities. The director is a clinical psychologist and says her film is a call for healing in a society that polices Black hair. She joins us to preview the film and discusses the natural hair movement with our guests. That's Tuesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. Let me grab Tim in Pittsford. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan, how are you?
Good.
I had a question for the doctor, maybe for everyone. About a year ago, I looked and did a lot of research into circadian rhythm and changing my lifestyle. I felt like I run a lot. I lift weights. I felt like I was in good shape, but didn't feel as good as I should. And I ended up signing up for a 14-week research study on circadian rhythm. And I changed from eating meat probably 4 to 5 days a week to going totally vegan. And it's not fasting for days. It would be 8 to 12 hours a day of you would eat and then have water and then eat again. And it was hard as hell, the hardest thing I probably have ever done. But I was in better shape at the end of that at 40 than I was at 20. I had never felt that way. I've never slept that well in my entire life. I lost 10 pounds, which before it I was 5'11", 160. I was down about 10 pounds. And I kept that going as far as fasting. So it's been almost a year now. And as far as veganism, I think I'm about 90% there. You know, like last night I had a dinner roll that wasn't vegan, but not the end of the world, but no more meat or fish or anything from animals.
Do you crave it, Tim, when you're around it?
Not at all.
That's interesting.
It's strange because, I mean, there were weeks where we'd have meat 7 nights a week. And I guess I looked at it this way, where I had already experienced all that, so I didn't feel like I was missing out on anything. It's hard work. It's hard to make meals like that, especially when you have a family. And my wife isn't vegan. She was a vegetarian, but she eats just about everything that I eat. But I think for a lot of people, it's not convenient. And to keep this going on, 14 weeks is hard enough. I can't see most people continuing that forever. I would like to continue it forever, but it is hard. It can be more expensive. I think you get a little more dialed in as far as the expense part. But I think people just want convenience, and when they see it's not convenient, they just kind of give up on it. And I know this is anecdotal, but it can't just be me. I mean,
one more quick question for you then, Tim. What would make it more convenient?
I don't know. A McDonald's for vegans, or
a fast food vegan joint.
Okay. Yeah, but people don't. You know what? People are uncomfortable with being hungry, And I'm sorry, but you're not supposed to eat 4,000 to 5,000 calories a day. Being hungry isn't awful for you. And it gets easier as time goes on. But when your stomach, it seems like it's trained to have that many calories, and all of a sudden you're not, that is unpleasant. And no one wants to feel unpleasant. And they want it to be fixed by food or medicine or whatever. But that's a reality, I think, for most people, unless you disagree with that.
Tim, thank you for that. I'll let everybody jump in. You directed Dr. Campbell. Go ahead, Tim.
So, Tim, first of all, it sounds like you've made some incredible changes and had some incredible health benefits. And so congratulations to you for doing that. I do think that in my experience working with patients, one of the most challenging things to long-term success is hunger. And generally, plans that leave you regularly hungry have a very, very low success rate. I mean, I think the best way to go about it is, now I will agree though that we tend to overeat, you know, we tend to eat way past hunger. So having a better relationship with when we are hungry, you know, a lot of people don't have a good awareness of hunger cues, for example. They don't have a good awareness of fullness cues. You know, we've gotten kind of divorced from those things. So if we have a good sense of when we're hungry and full and then just eat till we're comfortably full, that is very, very important. Absolutely. But if you're doing either, whether it's a variety of intermittent fasting or, you know, a general sort of low calorie approach, those can be great jump starts and great short-term things, but it has to expand. And it sounds like you've already been working on this, Tim, but it has, you know, to expand to, you know, just making healthier food choices so that you stay good and full, you know, comfortably full. Without over-consuming calories.
Where's the science on intermittent fasting?
So, you know, you can lose weight with intermittent fasting, just like with other low-calorie diets. It's the studies have come out have been impressively high dropout rates, as okay. I would say. So we think of it as sort of the easy thing, like, oh, I'll just eat whatever I want to for 8 hours a day or whatever, and just not eat the rest of the time. And the studies had very high dropout rates, meaning that people could not, you know, continue to participate in the plan. So it's not a magic bullet. Maybe there are situations or circumstances when it may be useful, but not for long-term lifestyle change.
Barbara?
Can I say something? The caller mentioned something about circadian rhythm, and that is really fascinating, the concept of how our body metabolizes food and processes food at 6 in the morning versus 11 o'clock at night. And there really is something to that. The research has shown that we do metabolize food differently, eating our calories very late at night versus eating our calories earlier in the day. And so I was wondering, how has that changed? And you've talked a lot about what you're eating, but how has it changed?
Well, we don't have Tim on the line anymore. But
how would it have changed from when you're actually eating?
Okay. And are you surprised, though, to hear him say he's sleeping better than he ever has in his life?
Sleep and eating go hand in hand. It's really amazing. Sleep...
Everything does, a little bit
of proxy in a way for health. And that's, you know, you could have a whole, I'm sure you have had shows on sleep because that's really important. But that he's sleeping better, I'm not surprised. No.
All right. Well, Emily and Barrett, you know, one of the things Tim is talking about here is how hard it was and how much he had to work at first. And well, now he's not having cravings like he used to, but it was a lot of work. And we've talked this hour about how We kind of like to be coddled. We like to be told it's okay. We don't want to feel bad about our choices. But when you've got clients who are making bad choices, are you blunt with them? Do you take sort of a tough love? Do you cater it to different personalities? Some people can take it better than others. Mm-hmm. Barrett, how do you handle that when someone clearly is making bad choices, but really what they are hoping is you're going to tell them their choices are okay?
Yeah, I think it is different for everyone, and you need to meet people, in my experience, need to meet people where they are and then help them change from there. And I don't think everyone responds to a very extreme change. Most people don't, in my experience. So listen, if I can get someone down to having one Coke a day versus five Cokes a day, I'm going to start there, even though they shouldn't be having any Coke, right? So I take it from an approach of let's see where you are. Let's try to make these small goals together. And then that way, over time, you know, these small goals are now your larger goals and it doesn't seem as extreme. So I think a lot of it is just maybe the population you're working with. So I kind of take a different approach on that.
Okay. Emily?
I also think it's important to take in consideration people's different knowledge levels. I sometimes catch myself thinking someone should know X, Y, Z because it's common knowledge, when a lot of times they're either misinformed, uneducated, and it's really, again, like Barrett said, our job to meet them in the middle, because we might think that they're making poor decisions, but it might just be a decision that's not educated. They might just not know. So you really do have to meet people in the middle, and you can't just assume that they're purposely making bad decisions if they don't know that they actually are.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That is a really, really good point. Jill writes to us and says, thanks for the discussion on healthy eating. Seems like everywhere I go, people want to give my toddler treats, and I have to say no thank you, from candies to cookies, anything sugary. 2 and 3-year-olds don't need that stuff. They need raisins and bananas. And I guess that kind of goes along the line with of what we talked about earlier, this food culture, the society that is constantly hitting us at work, us at the store, us at the hardware store, us at the mall, and our kids everywhere.
Yeah.
What would you say to Jill, who's trying to navigate this world and has a young child,
and
it's getting bombarded?
I have a 4-year-old myself, so I'm right there with you. I feel your pain immensely. And my personal approach is that I can only control the food that comes in and out of my home. So when we're outside, out and about, I do let him have a sucker if he wants to have a sucker at the bank. Those things I can't necessarily control, and they are part of our societal culture, but I can control that when he goes home, he's going to eat a healthful meal. And so I can't control what happens outside, but you can control what happens inside.
Okay, Barrett?
Yeah, I think you can. I agree with Emily. I mean, I personally don't have any children, but just from a dietitian standpoint, right, you control what you can. But because obviously your kids' eating habits start very, very early on. But I do know other dietitians that actually work with parents who have disordered eating, and they're kind of bringing it into their children's lives. So to go too extreme, I find, is a little slippery slope. Not that it's okay to constantly feed your kids cookies by any means, but I think to try to also teach somewhat, it's okay to have a cookie sometimes without, you know, having to shove fruit in that kid's mouth constantly if they want something sweet. So I think again, I don't have the perfect answer. I'm not a parent, but I think that it teeters between teaching your kids to be almost scared of food versus a healthy relationship with food.
Okay,
yeah.
Sure. Tom, can we be more blunt? If the people who are bombarding our kids are our own family members, maybe a grandparent, maybe someone else, can we be a little bit more direct with them?
Absolutely, yeah. I think you can be disagreeable in this regard. But, you know, I agree with everything that's been said in the sense that the most important thing is the home environment. So, you know, if you set a good example and keep a healthy home environment, that's priorities 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, getting a lollipop for behaving well after a haircut, for example, I mean, that's small potatoes, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah. Barbara?
Yeah, I agree with that, too. The important part with children is you want them, like Barrett said, to have a healthy relationship with food. And if you as a parent are going, no, they can't have that right away, that's setting up a negative relationship. And we all know, you know, the division of responsibility in feeding children is what? Parents are involved with what kind of foods are available and when it's available, the context, the eating utensils, the environment. Children do what? They determine whether they're going to eat and how much they're going to eat from what's served.
We have so many good questions coming in. We should have done 2 hours. Teresa writes to us and says, my husband's grandmother lived for 105 years, happy and healthy up to the end. And when people would ask her, what's your secret? She would say, everything in moderation, including moderation. She says, no offense to your panel, but I can't argue with Granny. I would just briefly say, not to divert the conversation too much or to question it, because Teresa, whatever she did worked for her. There's probably, Dr. Campbell, some genetics involved here.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the longest lived person ever well recorded in history was a French woman who lived to 122, and she enjoyed cigarettes up until the age of 115 when she lost her eyesight enough she couldn't light the cigarettes anymore.
Oh my goodness gracious.
She owned chocolate and olive oil and, you know, every week, you know. And of course, what do you hear in the headlines? You know, it's chocolate and olive oil for everybody now, all the time. Well, you know, I'm sorry, guys, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
let me get on the subject of, I think Barrett brought up, you want to teach kids especially healthy habits without making them fear food. And that right. is really important. I mean, having a son, watching him interact with his friends, you occasionally will bump into kids who are paralyzed about food, sometimes because of allergies, but sometimes for other reasons. And I found that really profound. And on those lines, that can happen with adults too. I want to get this question from a listener who says, can we talk about food shaming people? I have a sister who's a classic food shamer, criticizes other people for what they eat and how they aren't healthy enough. How can we have productive conversations without shaming?
Yeah, this drives me nuts. And I mean, yeah. from other people in here, dietitians, right? I was just asked even over the holidays, ooh, like, what's the dietitian eating for Thanksgiving? I'm like, everything, you know? So I think it's, we have to stop doing that. I think it makes people feel shameful of what they're eating, embarrassed. There's such a different way to approach it. But I mean, I even feel it when people eat around me, like I'm judging what they're eating. I don't care what you're eating unless you're my patient and you're asking me what you should eat, or vice versa, you know, I may have a big plate of food and maybe I shouldn't because I'm a dietitian. I don't know. So I think we just have to stop doing it. We have to stop worrying about what other people are eating unless they ask your opinion, your advice.
Okay. Well, Mark is the one who emailed there. Would you agree? Would you tell Mark the same thing?
I would tell Mark that I think we need to redefine healthy because healthy has a different definition for each and every person.
Yes.
What's healthy for me might not necessarily be healthy for you, even if it seems like we're eating the same types of things. So someone who just had colon surgery cannot eat raw fruits and vegetables. You might say that's an unhealthy diet, but for them, for that moment, that is healthy. So we really need to mind our own business, stay in our own lanes, and focus on what's healthy for us and not really care about what other people are eating.
Okay, Barbara?
Well, I guess I'd want to know, why are they doing this shaming? What's the rationale behind
it? I think some people would say they care. They care. They see people with bad habits. I'm not endorsing anything. I'm just saying that I'm trying to channel someone who might shame somebody else.
Right. But then if you care, doing it in a shaming way is not necessarily the way of showing you care.
Shaming almost never is effective in anything, whether it's food shaming, politics shaming. I mean, it just doesn't really work. But
yeah, I agree. And I think that there would need to be a deeper conversation that has more depth to it.
Right.
In terms of, rather than saying, oh, man, look at you eating that, or, oh, I wish I could have all that ice cream. Mm-hmm. I can't, because if I did, I would just gain 10 pounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a whole lot of psychology in that kind of a statement.
Yeah.
Okay, but on Dr. Campbell's side here, I want to ask you if there's a difference. Can we split the difference between shaming and saying, I'm going to proactively decide to talk to someone about food in a way that I think is constructive?
Mm-hmm. Right,
or should
different.
You always just mind your own business?
Well, I think generally you should mind your own business, to be honest. I think that, you know, people have to, on the shaming aspect, you have to realize from a sort of 10,000-foot view that so much of our behavior is determined by our environment. And so, you know, I really work with people, let's get rid of the idea of, like, being strong or weak or good or bad. You know, let's focus on getting your environment set up for success, and that's the process that yields the most results, I think. And just forget the self-shaming. You know, I think that's a huge aspect of the self-shaming. Mm. Like, oh, I ate that, but I shouldn't. But, you know, in general, food is very personal. I had a guy who was in a Catholic family, very large Catholic family. He switched to Mormonism as an adult, and then he switched to a plant-based diet after that. And he said his family gave him much more grief for switching over to a plant-based diet than to switching religions. And, you know, food is just so personal. It's so personal. I think the best way is to lead by example and just sort of, you know, keep it to yourself. Some people are genuinely interested. If they're genuinely interested, right. They want to engage in a dialogue, have a dialogue. But don't go around sort of imposing yourself on others.
All right, so 30 seconds apiece to wrap the program. The most common mistake you see made or maybe a constructive way to fix that this holiday season?
This little bit won't hurt. A poor food environment and throwing caution to the wind. So, for example, like daily weighing, one study showed that you could, if you stay conscious, basically, of what you're doing.
Okay. Barbara?
To me, a big problem is not liking yourself because of how you eat. Mm. I like yourself, you know. That's important.
Mm-hmm. That's good stuff. Barrett?
I would say stop saying the diet starts tomorrow. You know, everyone says they're on the holidays. I'll just eat this. The diet starts tomorrow. The diet starts Monday. The diet starts the new year. No, your healthy lifestyle's now. And if you choose to have what you're having, accept it, enjoy it, and the next meal, next day, go back to eating in a healthier mindset.
That's really good, especially this time of year, because you hear so many people say, well, starting in January.
Yeah.
We also know the research indicates is starting in February, they're done.
Right. Whenever they change. And every year you got to start again. That's exhausting.
Plus, my gym is always crowded in January. I'm like, people are not going to be here
exactly.
in a month.
Exactly. And they don't. They lean out. Yeah.
Emily.
Piggybacking right off of what Barrett said, it starts with your next bite, your next meal. Because it comes down to one meal at a time.
Yeah.
I want to thank our guests for being here. We tackled a lot of subjects and a lot of emails. Listeners, apparently we ought to do this like once a month because we could have gone all day with your feedback. Thanks to our guests for coming here. Emily Kyle is a registered dietitian and the owner of Emily Kyle Nutrition. Where can they find you?
EmilyKyleNutrition.com.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Barrett Young is the cupcake dietitian. Where can they find you, Barrett?
BarrettYoung.com.
And Barrett is B-E-R-I-T.
Yes.
BarrettYoung.com. Barbara Losey is a registered dietitian and head of the Wegman School of Health and Nutrition at RIT. I guess that's where they find you.
Exactly.
At RIT. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Dr. Tom Campbell, who is the medical director of Highland Hospital's Weight Management and Lifestyle Center. Where would you like people to find you?
Lifestylecenter.urmc.edu.
Thanks for taking the time. All of the panel here, great stuff and great feedback from the audience. So wherever you are today, I hope you are comfortable with the food choices you're making. Hope whatever you're making for dinner tonight, you love it. And our thanks to Rob Braden, who's got a pile of fruit that I'm going to go check out. He's the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. I know where the donuts are. They're in the newsroom. I'm going back to my office, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.